Here is the blackness of space, the myriad stars gleaming like diamond dust, or as some people would say, like great balls of exploding hydrogen a very long way off. But then some people would say anything. A shadow starts to blot out the distant glitter, and it is blacker than space itself. From here it also looks a great deal bigger, because space is not really big, it is simply somewhere to be big in. Planets are big, but planets are meant to be big, and there is nothing clever about being the right size. But this shape blotting out the sky like the footfall of God isn't a planet. It is a turtle, 10,000 miles long from its crater-pocked head to its armoured tail. And Great Artuin is huge. Great flippers rise and fall ponderously, warping space into strange shapes. The disk world slides across the sky like a royal barge. But even Great Artuin is struggling now, as it leaves the free depths of space and must fight the tormenting pressures of the solar shallows. Magic is weaker here, on the littoral of light. Many more days of this, and the disk world will be stripped away by the pressures of reality. Great Artuin knows this, but Great Artuin can recall doing all this before, many thousands of years ago. The Astro-Chelonian's eyes, glowing red in the light of the dwarf star, are not focused on it, but at a little patch of space nearby. "Yes, but where are we?" said Two-Flower. The shopkeeper hunched over his table, just shrugged. "I don't think we're anywhere," he said. "We're in a contingent incongruity, I believe. I could be wrong. The shop generally knows what it's doing."
"You mean you don't?"
"I pick up a bit here and there." The shopkeeper blew his nose. "Sometimes I land on a world where they understand these things." He turned a pair of small, sad eyes on Two-Flower. "You've got a kind face, sir. I don't mind telling you."
"Telling me what?"
"It's no life, you know, minding the shop, never settling down, always on the move, never closing."
"Why don't you stop, then?"
"Ah, that's it, you see, sir. I can't. I'm under a curse, I am. A terrible thing."
He blew his nose again.
"Cursed to run a shop. Forever, sir, forever. And never closing. For hundreds of years. There was this sorcerer, you see. I did a terrible thing."
"In a shop?" said Two-Flower.
"Oh, yes. I can't remember what it was he wanted, but when he asked for it, I gave one of those sucking in noises, you know, like whistling, only backwards," he demonstrated.
Two-Flower looked somber, but he was at heart a kind man, and always ready to forgive.
"I see," he said slowly. "Even so, that's not all."
"Oh,
I told him there was no demand for it."
"After making the sucking noise?"
"Yes, I probably grinned too."
"Oh, dear. You didn't call him Squire, did you?"
I may have done." "There's more."
"Surely not."
"Yes. I said I could order it and he could come back next day."
"That doesn't sound too bad," said Two-Flower, who alone of all the people in the multiverse allowed shops to order things for him and didn't object at all to paying quite large sums of money to reimburse the shopkeeper for the inconvenience of having a bit of stock in his store often for several hours.
"It was early closing day," said the shopkeeper.
"Oh?"
"Yes, and I heard him rattling the door handle. I had this sign on the door, you know, it said something like, 'Closed, even for the sale of necromancer cigarettes.' Anyway, I heard him banging, and I laughed."
"You laughed?"
"Yes, like this."
"Probably not a wise thing to do," said Two-Flower, shaking his head.
I know, my father always said, he said, do not peddle in the affairs of wizards. Anyway, I heard him shouting something about never closing again, and a lot of words I couldn't understand, and then the shop came alive."
"And you've wandered like this ever since?"
"Yes. I suppose one day I might find the sorcerer, and perhaps the thing he wanted will be in stock. Until then, I must go from place to place."
"That was a terrible thing to do," said Two-Flower. The shopkeeper wiped his nose on his apron.
"Thank you," he said.
"Even so, he shouldn't have cursed you quite so badly," Two-Flower added.
"Oh,
Yes. Well, the shopkeeper straightened his apron and made a brave little attempt to pull himself together. Anyway, this isn't getting you to Ankh-Morpork, is it? Funny thing is, said Twoflower, that I bought my luggage in a shop like this once. Another shop, I mean. Oh, yes, there's several of us, said the shopkeeper, turning back to the table. That sorcerer was a very impatient man, I understand. Endlessly roaming through the universe, mused Twoflower. That's right. Mind you, there is a saving on the rates. Rates? Yes, there. The shopkeeper paused and wrinkled his forehead. I can't quite remember, it was such a long time ago. Rates. Very large mice? Yes, that's probably it. Hold on. He's thinking about something, said Cohen. Lackjaw looked up wearily. It had been quite nice sitting here in the shade. He had just worked out that in trying to escape from a city of crazed madmen, he had appeared to have allowed one madman to give him his full attention. He wondered whether he would live to regret this. He earnestly hoped so.
Oh, yes, it's definitely thinking, he said bitterly. Anyone can see that.
I think he's found them.
Oh, good.
Hold on to it.
Are you mad? Said Lackjaw.
I know this thing, trust me. Anyway, would you rather be left with all these star people? They might be interested in having a talk with you.
Cohen sidled over to the luggage, and then flung himself astride it. It took no notice.
Hurry up, he said. I think it's going to go.
Lackjaw shrugged and climbed on gingerly behind Cohen.
Oh, he said, and how does it grow?
Ankh-Morpork, Pearl of Cities. This is not a completely accurate description, of course. It was not round and shiny. But even its worst enemies would agree that if you had to liken Ankh-Morpork to anything, then it might as well be a piece of rubbish covered with the diseased secretions of a dying mollusk. There have been bigger cities. There have been richer cities. There have certainly been prettier cities. But no city in the multiverse could rival Ankh-Morpork for its smell. The ancient ones, who know everything about all the universes and have smelt the smells of Calcutta and Kuzk and Dauntakumbh Musport, have agreed that even these fine examples of nasal poetry are mere limericks when set against the glory of the Ankh-Morpork smell. You can talk about ramps, you can talk about garlic, you can talk about France, go on, but if you haven't smelled Ankh-Morpork on a hot day, you haven't smelled anything. The citizens are proud of it. They carry chairs outside to enjoy it on a really good day. They puff out their cheeks and slap their chests and comment cheerfully on its little distinctive nuances. They've even put up a statue to it to commemorate the time when the troops of a rival state tried to invade by stealth one dark night and managed to get to the top of the walls before, to their horror, their nose plugs gave out. Rich merchants who have spent many years abroad sent back home for specially stoppered and sealed bottles of the stuff, which brings tears to their eyes. It has that kind of effect. There is only really one way to describe the effect the smell of Ankh-Morpork has on the visiting nose, and that is by analogy. Take a tartan, sprinkle it with confetti, light it with strobe lights, now take a chameleon. Put the chameleon on the tartan, watch it closely. See? Which explains why, when the shop finally materialized in Ankh-Morpork, Rincewind sat bolt upright and said, "We're here." Bethan went pale, and Twoflower, who had no sense of smell, said, "Really? How can you tell?" It had been a long afternoon. They had broken into real space in a number of walls in a variety of cities because, according to the shopkeeper, the disc's magical field was playing up and upsetting it. All the cities were empty of most of their citizens and belonged to roaming gangs of crazed left-ear people. "Where do they all come from?" said Twoflower, as they fled yet another mob.
"Inside every sane person there's a madman struggling to get out," said the shopkeeper. "That's what I've always thought. No one goes mad quicker than a totally sane person."
"That doesn't make sense," said Bethan. "Or if it makes sense, I don't like it."
The star was bigger than the sun. There would be no night tonight. On the opposite horizon, the disk's own sunlight was doing its best to set normally, but the general effect of all that red light was to make the city, never particularly beautiful, look like something painted by a fanatical artist after a bad time on the shoe polish. But it was home. Rincewind peered up and down the empty street and felt almost happy. At the back of his mind, the spell was kicking up a ruckus, but he ignored it. Maybe it was true that magic was getting weaker as the star got nearer. Or perhaps he'd had the spell in his head for so long he had built up some kind of psychic immunity. But he found he could resist it. "We're in the docks," he declared. "Just smell that sea air." "Oh," said Bethan, leaning against the wall. "Yes."
"That's ozone, that is," said Rincewind. "That's air with character, that is."
He breathed deeply. Twoflower turned to the shopkeeper. "Well, I hope you find your sorcerer," he said. "Sorry we didn't buy anything, but all my money's in my luggage, you see." The shopkeeper pushed something into his hand.
"A little gift," he said. "You'll need it."
He darted back into his shop. The bell jangled. The sign saying, "Call again tomorrow for spoon fetchers leeches, the little suckers," banged forlornly against the door, and the shop faded into the brickwork as though it had never been. Twoflower reached out gingerly and touched the wall, not quite believing it.
"What's in the bag?" said Rincewind.
It was a thick brown paper bag with string handles. "If it sprouts legs, I don't want to know about it," said Bethan. Twoflower peered inside and pulled out the contents.
"Is that all?" said Rincewind. "A little house with shelves on?"
"It's very useful," said Twoflower defensively. "You can keep cigarettes in it."
"And they're what you really need, are they?" said Rincewind.
"I'd plump for a bottle of really strong suntan oil," said Bethan.
"Come on," said Rincewind, and set off down the street. The others followed.
It occurred to Twoflower that some words of comfort were called for, a little tactful small talk to take Bethan out of herself, as he would put it, and generally cheer her up.
"Don't worry," he said. "There's just a chance that Cohen might still be alive."
"Oh, I expect he's alive, all right," she said, stamping along the cobbles as if she nursed a personal grievance against each one of them. "You don't live to be 87 in his job if you go around dying all the time. But he's not here." "Nor is my luggage," said Twoflower. "Of course, that's not the same thing." "Do you think the star is going to hit the disk?" "No," said Twoflower confidently. "Why not?" "Because Rincewind doesn't think so." She looked at him in amazement. "You see," the tourist went on, "you know that thing you do with seaweed?" Bethan, brought up on the Vortex Plains, had only heard of the sea in stories, and had decided she didn't like it. She looked blank.
"Eat it?"
"No. What you do is you hang it up outside your door, and it tells you if it's going to rain." Another thing Bethan had learned was that there was no real point in trying to understand anything Twoflower said, and that all anyone could do was run alongside the conversation and hope to jump on as it turned a corner.
"I see," she said.
"Rincewind is like that, you see."
"Like seaweed?"
"Yes. If there was anything at all to be frightened about, he'd be frightened. But he's not. The star is just about the only thing I've ever seen him not frightened of. If he's not worried, then take it from me, there's nothing to worry about."
"It's not going to rain," said Bethan.
"Well, no, metaphorically speaking."
"Oh."
Bethan decided not to ask what metaphorically meant, in case it was something to do with seaweed. Rincewind turned around.
"Come on," he said. "Not far now."
"Where to?"
said Twoflower.
"Unseen University, of course."
"Is that wise?"
"Probably not, but I'm still going."
Rincewind paused, his face a mask of pain. He put his hand to his ears and groaned.
"Spell giving you trouble?"
"Yeah."
"Try humming."
Rincewind grimaced. "I'm going to get rid of this thing," he said thickly. "It's going back into the book where it belongs. I want my head back." "But then," Twoflower began and stopped. They could all hear it, a distant chanting and the stamping of many feet.
"Do you think it's the star, people?" said Bethan.
It was. The lead marchers came around a corner 100 yards away, behind a ragged white banner with an 8-pointed star on it.
"Not just star people," said Twoflower, "all kinds of people."
The crowd swept them up in its passage. One moment they were standing in the deserted street, the next they were perforce moving with a tide of humanity that bore them onwards through the city. Torchlight flickered easily on the damp tunnels far under the university as the heads of the 8 orders of wizardry filed onwards.
"At least it's cool down here," said one. "We shouldn't be down here."
Trumon, who was leading the party, said nothing, but he was thinking very hard. He was thinking about the bottle of oil in his belt and the 8 keys the wizards carried. 8 keys that would fit the 8 locks that chained the octavo to its lectern. He was thinking that old wizards who sense that magic is draining away are preoccupied with their own problems and are perhaps less alert than they should be. He was thinking that within a few minutes the octavo, the greatest concentration of magic on the disc, would be under his hands. Despite the coolness of the tunnel, he began to sweat. They came to a lead-lined door set in the sheer stone. Trumon took a heavy key, a good, honest iron key, not like the twisted and disconcerting keys that would unlock the octavo, and gave the lock a squirt of oil, inserted the key, turned it. The lock squeaked open protestingly.
"Are we of one resolve?" said Trumon.
There was a series of vaguely affirmative grunts. He pushed at the door. A warm gale of thick and somehow oily air rolled over them. The air was filled with a high-pitched and unpleasant chittering. Tiny sparks of octarine fire flared off every nose, fingernail, and beard. The wizards, their heads bowed against the storm of randomized magic that blew out of the room, pushed forward. Half-formed shapes giggled and fluttered around them as the nightmare inhabitants of the dungeon dimensions constantly probed, with things that passed for fingers only because they were at the ends of their arms, for an unguarded entry into the circle of firelight that passed for the universe of reason and order. Even at this bad time for all things magical, even in a room designed to damp down all magical vibrations, the octavo was still crackling with power. There was no real need for the torches. The octavo filled the room with a dull, sullen light, which wasn't strictly light at all, but the opposite of light. Darkness isn't the opposite of light. It is simply its absence. And what was radiating from the book was the light that lies on the far side of darkness. The light fantastic. It was a rather disappointing purple colour. As has been noted before, the octavo was chained to a lectern carved into the shape of something that looked vaguely avian, slightly reptilian, and horribly alive. 2 glittering eyes regarded the wizards with hooded hatred.
"I saw it move," said one of them.
"We're safe so long as we don't touch the book," said Trumon.
He pulled a scroll out of his belt and unrolled it.
"Bring that torch here," he said, "and put that cigarette out."
He waited for the explosion of infuriated pride, but none came. Instead, the offending mage removed the dog end from his lips with trembling fingers and ground it into the floor. Trumon exulted.
"So," he thought, "they do what I say. Just for now, maybe, but just for now is enough."
He peered at the crabby writing of a wizard long dead.
"Right," he said. "Let's see. To appease it, the thing that is the guardian."
The crowd surged over one of the bridges that linked Moorpork with Ankh. Below it, the river, turgid at the best of times, was a mere trickle which steamed. The bridge shook under their feet rather more than it should. Strange ripples ran across the muddy remains of the river. A few tiles slid off the roof of a nearby house. "What was that?" said Twoflower. Bethan looked behind them and screamed. The star was rising. As the disc's own sun scurried for safety below the horizon, the great bloated ball of the star climbed slowly into the sky until the whole of it was several degrees above the edge of the world. They pulled Rincewind into the safety of a doorway. The crowd hardly noticed them, but ran on, terrified as lemmings.
"The star's got spots on," said Twoflower.
"No," said Rincewind. "They're things. Things going around the star, like the sun goes around the disc. But they're close in because..." He paused. "I nearly know."
"Know what?"
"I've got to get rid of this spell."
"Which way is the university?" said Bethan.
"This way," said Rincewind, pointing along a street.
"It must be very popular. That's where everyone's going." "I wonder why," said Twoflower.
"Somehow," said Rincewind, "I don't think it's to enroll for evening classes." In fact, Unseen University was under siege, or at least those parts of it that extruded into the usual everyday dimensions were under siege. The crowds outside its gates were, generally, making one of two demands. They were demanding that either, A, the wizards should stop messing about and get rid of the star, or, and this was the demand favoured by the star people, that, B, they should cease all magic and commit suicide in good order, thus ridding the disk of the curse of magic and warding off the terrible threat in the sky. The wizards on the other side of the walls had no idea how to do A, and no intention of doing B, and many had in fact plumped for C, which largely consisted of nipping out of hidden side doors and having it away on their toes as fast as possible, if not faster. What reliable magic still remained in the university was being channeled into keeping the great gates secure. The wizards were learning that while it was all very fine and impressive to have a set of gates that were locked by magic, it ought to have occurred to the builders to include some sort of emergency backup device, such as, for example, a pair of ordinary, unimpressive, stout iron bolts. In the square outside the gates, several large bonfires had been lit, for effect as much as anything else, because the heat from the star was scorching. "But you can still see the stars," said Twoflower. "The other stars, I mean. The little ones. In a black sky." Rincewind ignored him. He was looking at the gates. A group of star people and citizens were trying to batter them down. "It's hopeless," said Bethan. "We'll never get in. Where are you going?" "For a walk," said Rincewind. He was setting off determinedly down a side street. There were one or two freelance rioters here, mostly engaged in wrecking shops. Rincewind took no notice, but followed the wall until it ran parallel to a dark alley that had the usual unfortunate smell of all alleys everywhere. Then he started looking very closely at the stonework. The wall here was 20 feet high and topped with cruel metal spikes. "I need a knife," he said. "You going to cut your way through? Just find me a knife," said Rincewind. He started to tap stones. "Shops have been smashed open. There was a whole bunch of people across the street helping themselves to musical instruments. Can you believe that?" "Yeah," said Rincewind, picking up a knife and testing its blade thoughtfully. "Looters, I expect." He thrust the blade into the wall, twisted it, and stepped back as a heavy stone fell out. He looked up, counting under his breath, and levered another stone from its socket. "How did you do that?" said Twoflower. "Just give me a leg up, will you?" said Rincewind. A moment later, his feet wedged into the holes he had created, he was making further steps halfway up the wall. "It's been like this for centuries," his voice floated down. "Some of the stones haven't got any mortar. Secret entrance, see? Watch out below!" Another stone cracked onto the cobbles. "Students made it long ago," said Rincewind. "Handy way in and out after lights out."
"Ah," said Twoflower, "I understand. Over the wall and out to brightly lit tavernas to drink and sing and recite poetry, yes?"
"Nearly right, except for the singing and the poetry, yes," said Rincewind. "Couple of these spikes should be loose." There was a clang. "There's not much of a drop this side," came his voice after a few seconds. "Come on, then, if you're coming."
And so it was that Rincewind, Twoflower and Bethan entered Unseen University. Elsewhere on the campus, the eight wizards inserted their keys, and with many a worried glance at one another, turned them. There was a faint little snicking sound as the lock slid open. The Octavo was unchained. A faint octarine light played across its bindings. Trumon reached out and picked it up, and none of the others objected. His arm tingled. He turned towards the door.
"Now to the Great Hall, brothers," he said, "if I may lead the way."
And there were no objections. He reached the door with the book tucked under his arm. It felt hot and somehow prickly. At every step he expected a cry, a protest. And none came. He had to use every ounce of control to stop himself from laughing. It was easier than he could have imagined. The others were halfway across the claustrophobic dungeon by the time he was through the door, and perhaps they had noticed something in the set of his shoulders, but it was too late, because he had crossed the threshold, gripped the handle, slammed the door, turned the key, smiled the smile. He walked easily back along the corridor, ignoring the enraged screams of the wizards who had just discovered how impossible it is to pass spells in a room built to be impervious to magic. The Octavo squirmed, but Trumon held it tightly. Now he ran, putting out of his mind the horrible sensations under his arm as the book shape-changed into things hairy, skeletal, and spiky. His hand went numb. The faint chittering noises he had been hearing grew in volume, and there were other sounds behind them. Leering sounds, beckoning sounds, sounds made by the voices of unimaginable horrors that Trumon found it all too easy to imagine. As he ran across the great hall and up the main staircase, the shadows began to move and reform and close in around him. And he also became aware that something was following, something with skittery legs moving obscenely fast. Ice formed on the walls. Doorways lunged at him as he barreled past. Underfoot, the stairs began to feel just like a tongue. Not for nothing had Trumon spent long hours in the university's curious equivalent of a gymnasium, building up mental muscle. Don't trust the senses, he knew, because they can be deceived. The stairs are there somewhere. Will them to be there. Summon them into being as you climb, and boy, you better be good at it, because this isn't all imagination. Great Artuin slowed. With flippers the size of continents, the Sky Turtle fought the pull of the star and waited. There would not be long to wait.